And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we do come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. The podcasts are on the homepage of richarddugan.com via SoundCloud, as well as on Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, Blueberry, and a bunch of other places that we encourage you to go to. And click on that little grocery cart when you're listening to the SoundCloud podcast, because that'll take you to our guest website. We'll be giving that to you shortly so that you can continue the process of education, inspiration, just continue to move forward. If you'd like to support this program, we're grateful for that. We thank those who have supported and those who will. We have a PayPal and Patreon account. The links are on the homepage as well as on the radio show's page and the missions page. And if you'd like to read what we're all about, please do so. And we encourage you to check out our guest website. And as I said, we'll be giving that to you here in just a couple of minutes. I just want to let you know that we've been doing this program for now. We're into our 13th year, very lucky year, in my opinion. And we are very grateful for the opportunity to bring you a wide variety of ideas and concepts. Today is no different because today we're going to be talking with a gentleman who, there we go. I'm trying to read off of my phone, and every time I touch it, it goes black. And that's only because of an app I have open that says, if you get too close, we're going to turn off the screen. Thank you so much. There we go. And we're going to be talking with Douglas J. Brower. He is a seasoned American pastor. He's basically going to talk to us about how to become a multicultural church. And I think that as individuals, we can take in this information as well. Doug, first of all, thank you so much for joining us here on the program, all the way from Switzerland as you were on your travels. It's great to have you on the program.
Hello, Richard. Thank you for having me.
Now, the interesting thing about this is that we have been discussing on this program from time to time the whole aspect of multiculturalism, not just in this country, which is pretty obvious. I mean, what is it? The phrase they love to use is, you know, we're the melting pot, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But when it comes to interacting in other countries with, I'll use the term, the indigenous peoples. In China, you're dealing with the Chinese, Japan, Japanese, Switzerland, the Swiss, et cetera, et cetera. And they all have their own culture, their own way of doing things, their own way of speaking, et cetera, et cetera. If you go into a particular country, and I've been saying this for the last few days in this regard, and I say this facetiously because this isn't necessarily true, although I think there may be some countries this would happen. If you raise your hand in the wrong gesture, that could get you killed. You say the wrong phrase. All right. I seem to remember that there were some manufacturers, some products that were being distributed and sold in China, or maybe it was Japan. I forget which. They had to change the name of the product in that country because the name of that product in this country, the United States, was extremely derogatory. But they didn't know that until after the fact. And it's like, oh, wait a minute. But what we're talking about here is on a deeper level, as I'm sure you would agree, when it comes to sharing with people our respective philosophies, you can't just walk in and say, this is the way it is. This is what you're going to have to do. And it's either that or, it's either this way or the highway kind of thing. And that doesn't go over real well around the world. How do you begin the process? Let's say you're going to a country you've never been before. How do you begin that process?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, let me back up. Most people stay with people they know from their own racial and ethnic groups, so we rarely venture out from what's familiar to us. And that's true for the church, too. I think it was in the 1960s that Martin Luther King Jr. said 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. And that continues to be true all these decades later. So when you go into a different country, different country or continent, you're almost immediately thrust into a whole different kind of situation. And most of us are not prepared for that.
Hmm. So how different, just for the sake of argument here, how different is the culture in Switzerland, where you are, as compared to that of the United States, where you are natively from?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And you would think that we had so much in common. You would think that there'd be enough common denominators that we could get along very well. But the truth of the matter is, you don't have to move very far before customs and habits change. So on top of everything else, there's a language barrier. Now, most Swiss, especially the younger ones, speak English. But just sharing a common language doesn't always give you enough to go on. The behaviors are so different. Tourists are probably not going to experience this. They're in a whole separate category, and often they travel in bubbles. But if you go somewhere like Switzerland and live for a while, it doesn't take very long before you bump into different ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long have you been traveling the globe in regards to, in your instance, you're spreading the gospel and you're helping to other churches to grow or you're helping to seed, shall we say, churches in other parts of the world as well. How many countries have you been to thus far? Have you kept count?
Yeah, I've lost count, Richard. but I have to say that traveling is not the same as living somewhere. I've traveled a great deal, and I thought that would have prepared me for this experience. And the truth of the matter is, living somewhere is altogether different from travel.
Hmm. And the response that you get as you do travel, and again, I understand the difference in terms of that particular country's receptivity to you, an American.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just to give you an example, I lived for about 5 years in Zurich and then retired and moved back to the U.S. But I have a short term assignment now back in Switzerland in Luzerne this time. And I've been here for a month, and I'm trying to open a bank account so I can get paid. But Americans are not highly thought of in the banks here, because up until I forget how many years ago it was, with a relatively short time, the U.S. changed the banking industry in Switzerland. So the whole idea of banking secrecy has gone away. And banking has been a business in Switzerland for centuries. And as I said, within the last few years, that has all changed. And it's thanks to American courts. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you wouldn't think that would affect me, but it has directly. They're not very happy about opening a bank account for me because of this recent history.
And obviously, it creates those kinds of challenges. That's as you state. And yet, you know, even here in the United States, there are challenges. Even though, if you declare yourself a church, as it were, then you you get this protection. You don't have to pay taxes. It's one thing. I think it's probably the one thing that most people know about. The financial aspects of churches in general is they don't have to pay taxes on the money that they collect from their respective congregations. And so you've got these different challenges. Have you been to Asian countries, China, Southeast Asia, and so forth?
Yes, Thailand and Philippines, yes. But my travel is... I've traveled much more extensively in Europe, I have to say.
And how was your reception in those countries, the Thailand and so forth. Were you, so to speak, greeted with open arms or skepticism, or, okay, we know who you are and where you're from, and you just better watch your step because we'll be watching you?
Yeah, I'm sure they were watching. I'm sure people were paying attention to us. And any American who travels probably ought to be careful with personal behavior. But the fact of the matter is, whenever I went abroad, it was usually on a mission trip. We were building a house, or, you know, we were working in a children's center, dental clinic. So more often than not, these countries were very happy to have us come aboard. I don't think there was any hostility at all.
I mean, I know there's a big difference between the people versus the government. That's kind of what a lot of folks here in the States feel the same way. There's a big difference between that group of people out there on the East Coast or here in California in Sacramento or what have you, as opposed to the citizens, you know, of the people, by the people, for the people, who, you know, they want to get to know people, they want to try to understand people, and so forth. Is that your experience abroad as well?
You know, that may be one characteristic that we share with people around the globe. I hadn't thought about it in quite this way, but I was in Peru one summer. I was there over their Independence Day, and I remarked to somebody, I was on the street watching the parade, and I remarked to somebody that I said, oh, they're very patriotic. And the person I said it to, a Peruvian, said, well, they love their country. They don't always love their government.
Yeah, I had a...
And I thought, okay, I understand that one. Right, and that's true in many places. They love their country. They don't always love their government.
A buddy of mine, a dear friend of mine who's since passed, he had a Blazer truck, and he had a bumper sticker on it, and it said, I love my country. It's the government I don't trust. That was the bumper sticker that he had on his truck. And yeah. I kind of feel the same way in that respect. And what it comes down to, of course, in any country is that if the people don't do something, then nothing gets done. Yes, the governments can control the military and so forth. But it's like, and again, we don't want to quite go to this extreme, but they can only kill you once. Okay. So if you stand up to the government and they kill you, well, then they can't control you anymore. You're done. It's just like Paul says, you know, fear the one who can kill the soul, not the body. But again, we don't want to go to those extremes. How did you become a pastor? When did that begin for you?
Yeah, I'm. Thank you for asking that question. I'm probably one of the last of my kind. I went right from college to seminary. So I was ordained very early in my life, and I've been at this now for 40 years. But I think the average pastor these days is usually a second career person. Mm-hmm. So after college, there's usually a work experience and then a call to ministry. So, I mean, that would be more the norm today. But I got into it very early in my life.
Why?
Short answer, I had a life-changing experience. I mean, I don't know what you were expecting, but that's the answer. I thought I was headed in one direction, and abruptly, suddenly, I found myself doing something completely different.
What was the catalytic moment, if you will, that basically said to you, I need to get into ministry. I need to become a pastor, and I need to go out and share this philosophy with people.
Yeah, I love this story, so I'm glad you asked. And what happened was that during summers, my college days, I was working at a publishing company, a Christian publishing company, and I loved the work, and I noticed that the senior editors all had advanced theological degrees. And I thought, okay, if this is my career path, I'd better go to seminary. And so off I went, and I liked it. And I had nothing against the church, but I also wasn't going to church all that much. And then after my second year, I realized I was not going to graduate unless I worked in a church. And I mean, that may seem obvious to you. It wasn't obvious to me at the time. And they were not going to change the rules. So between my second and third years of seminary, I went to work in a church in Iowa City, Iowa, of all places. I went about as far from the seminary as I could possibly get. And it was there that I had a life-changing experience. I mean, I wasn't very good, and I didn't show a lot of promise for ministry. But they loved me, and I loved them. And during the course of that year, I had, as I said, an abrupt change, a realization that this was what I was born to do. And so I went back to the seminary for my third and final year with a whole different vocational vision. I'm glad you asked.
Now, I, just to give you a point of reference, worked from 1980 to 1995 in Phoenix, Arizona, for a Christian radio station. And I was always full of questions. And to the point, to the consternation of many of the programmers, many of the call screeners when we did live programs where they took calls, even to the consternation of the general manager, who was not, you know, real pleased with a particular interview that I had conducted. Hadn't aired it, but it was with an organization called CAMP, and it was called Christians and Muslims for Peace. Now, this was long before the brouhahas that started up in the 90s. And he was in town from Vegas, basically sharing his, you know, his understanding of the comparisons, the similarities between Christians and Muslims. He even made the comment to me, said that Christians and Muslims have more in common than do Christians Muslims and Jews. I can't even say it right. Christians and Muslims have more in common than Jews and Muslims, he said, which I thought was rather interesting. The upshot basically was that my boss never liked surprises, so I always informed him if something was up. So I got a call from a woman who claimed that our station was being used by the devil, this gentleman, and so on and so forth. It turns out she was a traveling heckler of his. He wasn't employing her. She followed him everywhere he went to try to warn people because she didn't care much for his teachings. And so I call my boss. I tell him about it. He says, I want to hear the interview. Now, this is where it got very strange, and this is kind of what I want to talk to you a little bit about. The very first question out of his mouth after he listened to the interview and this phone conversation that we had, and by the way, the reason it was a phone conversation was because he was at the business offices in Phoenix. I was 10 miles outside of town at the transmitter site where we broadcast from, going back to old school, if you will. First question out of his mouth was, are you a Muslim? And I thought, that's a weird question. Now, someone would say today, oh, you've got a great lawsuit on your hands now. He can't ask you that. It didn't bother me. I just thought it was kind of weird. And I said, no, I'm just curious. That's why I do this program, Douglas. I'm curious. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on, and I'm going to go back even further, going into other countries to establish churches to share the gospel. Why not use the church's method? And we're talking going back a few centuries. Why not use the church's method, i.e. the Spanish Inquisition and all of that? You know, I thought, according to history, that was pretty darn successful. And I say that tongue-in-cheek.
No, no. Well, first of all, I'm sorry for your experience, and I have to say it's not terribly surprising. The church has, sadly, a reputation for being intolerant and judgmental, and it can be scolding. So, yeah, I have to say I'm not surprised, but I'm sorry for that experience. What I've discovered, let me back up a second. Mm-hmm. The first 35 years of my ministry were spent in the U.S., and I served homogeneous churches, white, suburban. We thought alike, and we voted alike, and so on. And then I don't know, I was about 60 years old when I took my first assignment abroad, and I was suddenly in a group of people who thought very differently from the way I was raised to think. I mean, we all believed in God, but we came with different political philosophies, different perspectives on life. Mm-hmm. It was mind-boggling at first. And so here's, and I write about this in my book quite a bit. I came with an attitude of humility, and I began to listen as I had never listened before, trying to understand why people believed what they did, why they had the perspectives that they did. And I believe now that that willingness to listen and that attitude of humility is what's necessary for survival in a multicultural situation. Mm. I mean, anyone who comes into a situation like that thinking that he or she knows all the answers is just doomed. I mean, there's never going to be dialogue. You started by saying you're curious, and I think a curious spirit is what leads to friendship and understanding.
Great line that was told to me when, in my 20s, early 20s, when I would start spouting certainties about certain things. They said to me, along the lines of what you're saying, it is better to begin in doubt and end in certainty than to begin in certainty and end in doubt. And I got to tell you, I've hung on to that the rest of my life, because there are no, in spite of what is written, okay, there's still no guarantees. We still don't actually know. We haven't experienced it. We believe, right? We have our beliefs. And I'm curious as to the experiences that you've had in your efforts to understand someone else's perspective. How has that changed your both beliefs as well as knowing about God and the universe and humanity and our souls, and some of those aspects of maybe death and dying, or coming into this world, or living in this world, and so forth?
Well, don't get me wrong. When I came here, I had some definite ideas about things, and I think I've been well-trained theologically. It's not as though I didn't have beliefs of my own, but in order to engage any human being in conversation, there needs to be a willingness to listen for how the other person believes about, for the attitudes and perspectives that the other person brings. And only then can there be dialogue. I'll just give you one example. This is a big one for me in my context. This may not seem like all that much to you, but I grew up in a tradition that baptized babies. So I think there are good theological reasons for that, and that's what I knew, and that's what I did. And then I found myself in this international context. Well, they don't baptize babies. I mean, that's completely foreign, so to speak, to most global Christians. And so there was the first time in my life where I had to listen very closely to another point of view. And I'll just, to make this story short, during my time in Zurich, I was in Lake Zurich more than once, baptizing new Christians by immersion. Now, how could I do that? Well, I don't think I gave up my own beliefs and perspectives. I still believe the things that I brought to that situation. But I allowed myself to see these traditional teachings from another point of view, and I could honor them and respect them without giving up my own. You know, can I say one more thing about that?
No, please go ahead. We have plenty of time.
I think that there's an analogy here to the military chaplain, right? So if I'm a Presbyterian pastor, and if I'm a military chaplain, I'm expected to serve people from a great variety of backgrounds. And something similar to that is going on in my work today. I'm not serving Muslims or Jews or Buddhists, but I'm serving other Christians who have very different beliefs, and I think it's my job to honor those other beliefs and to understand them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I hope that makes sense.
It does, because years ago, back in that period of time of mine, that 15 years, I interviewed a Christian author who had written a book. His name is John Noe, and he wrote a book called The Apocalypse Conspiracy, which I thought was a rather interesting title. And he had done his own research and so forth, i.e. he had placed, say, his Strong's Concordance next to his Bible, and he began doing some study. Now, one of the things that you talk about in your book that relates to this is learning the language. Well, I don't speak Aramaic. I don't speak Hebrew. I can't read either of them. I don't read Greek, whether old or new. I know a few Greek phrases, opa and ephalisto, but that's about as far as it goes. And gyro, or is it gyro? I never know. But this gentleman did some research. Now, what I found so fascinating, and this isn't getting into the discussion of dogma here or doctrine, but it was just an interesting example. I know you're familiar with what is referred to as the rapture passage in the New Testament, where Paul is basically saying, that they'll be caught up to meet him in the air in the clouds of glory, right?
Right.
And it goes on. Well, he took a look at that passage based upon a lot of the other stuff that he had written in the book. Now, I read his book cover to cover. It was actually, I'm going to say, 8 years I had been working there, and it was the first book I'd actually read from cover to cover from one of the authors that I'd interviewed, that I was going to interview, and I'd highlighted like crazy. But I didn't want to sit here and say, well, Douglas, John in his book, he says da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I wanted to make that information mine. So I pulled out my Strong's Concordance and I pulled out my Bible, and based upon his information, I went searching as well. And the word that he focused on in that passage was the word air. And there are two definitions that are used in the New Testament for the word air. One is the atmosphere. The clouds and the birds fly through the air and the clouds float along and so forth. And then there's the other that is associated with God breathing the breath of life into the nostrils of Adam. And it was related to the soul, the spirit, the essence, the immortal part of who we are. Guess what definition is used in that passage? It's not the first one. And so when he put it all that together with a lot of the other stuff that he'd done, what he came to the conclusion was that the church was leading people down a primrose path, trying to teach them about this external life that they're supposed to live, when in fact, and I've used this term before and some people don't quite get it, Christianity is a metaphysical philosophy. And metaphysical, the definition is beyond the physical. And that passage refers to an internal rapture, if you will, or internal process. And I went through some of the other things that he looked up, and I thought, wow. And then, of course, I started thinking about that in terms of Hebrew, for example, the Old Testament, the Torah, and so forth, and Aramaic, and the Greek, and so forth. And it's like, with Hebrew, you have the 22 letters of the alphabet. Each one of them has its own legend, just like with a map. You have that little key down at the bottom that shows you what the symbols mean. Well, each letter has the same kind of thing, has a numerical rating, has a tonal rating, a vibration, and so forth and so on, has a story. And you start putting those letters into words and you create a whole new legend, and words into sentences, into paragraphs, into chapters, into a book. But when you then take and translate it into another language, all that goes away. You lose the context. So I'm wondering about when you travel around the world, how do you get into context with that culture, with its people, to understand them, but at the same time, hopefully to get them to understand you?
Yes. First of all, my hat is off to you for doing the kind of Bible study you did. The tradition I grew up in, the Presbyterian or Reformed tradition, is one of the last that requires biblical languages of its students. So Greek and Hebrew are still required.
Oh, you lucky dog, you. I'm not kidding you.
We're
so, in the United States, we're so deprived in that regard. Anyway, let me let you continue.
Well, it wasn't easy. I'm not claiming that. But, I mean, how do you understand a Bible that was originally written in a different language? Well, you have to understand that language. Is it, as you're alluding to, in order to understand a culture, I think one of the first things you need to do is to understand the language. And you may be surprised to hear me say this, but I think that immigrants to the United States need to learn English. It just seems obvious to me.
Mm-hmm.
When I moved to Switzerland, I was required to learn German. I lived in the German-speaking, I mean, there are four national languages. I lived in the German-speaking portion, and I was required to learn the language, and I did my best. I think if I had been 5 years old, I'd be fluent by now.
Mm-hmm.
I think an older brain has a very difficult time learning a new language.
Yeah,
but the reason I don't think fluency was really what they were after. This gets to your point. I think what they wanted to know was that I was engaging their culture.
Yeah.
Right? And so when you learn someone's language, then you learn how they express themselves. Yeah, I mean, I had all kinds of insights into this Swiss-German culture because I began to learn their language. I'm hardly fluent.
Does it also say to them, from your experience, does it also say to them, you really do give a damn about us? You really do care? You're sincere?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So it depends on what country you go to. If you go to France, for example, and you begin to speak French, I think they like that. Here, if you begin to speak German with someone in a restaurant, for example, your server, they almost immediately switch to English, which doesn't help the learning. But I think they do that partly to practice and partly to show off and. But they like it that you've made the attempt,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. They like it that you have gone so far as to understand them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the point you're getting at.
Yeah.
How well do you want to get to know me?
Yeah. And also, too, that you're not you don't have a hidden agenda. I mean, you come out there with your arms open wide and saying, this is who I am, and this is why I am here. I'm not here to put you in chains and to. We're not doing the Spanish Inquisition here, ladies and gentlemen. Because I find it interesting that, as you say, and I tend to agree with you that people coming to this country, immigrants should learn the language. As a matter of fact, I know that for example, on my ex-wife's side of the family, they were from Russia. And believe it or not, the Bolshevik Revolution that took place was an event that could have changed my personal history. It was my ex-wife's grandfather who escaped the night before, and he could have been killed, and then she never would have existed, and so forth and so on. So it's real interesting when you start taking a look back. But what I find interesting, too, is when my present wife and I traveled to Ireland, and we've been there twice. Fortunately, they speak English.
What we
found so fascinating was our desire to learn Gaelic. And there is a phrase my wife and I say to each other every time we depart or every time we end a phone call, aside from I love you, is a phrase that a lot of people hear quite often in movies and television and so forth. Half of it is called, it's slán. And then we add to that slán gafal, which is basically, we'll see you later. And we end it every time. And I get questions from some people when I get off the phone, if they happen to be in earshot, what was that you just said? You know, and then I'll share the story of it. But we even took a Gaelic course here back in Phoenix when we were living there at the Irish Cultural Center. We went there and we did our best to learn what we could because we were so intrigued.
Yeah, good for you.
But it's when you go to other countries and you just figure, oh, no, they'll speak English. You can't count on that. And you're going there with a very specific, but also, I'm going to put it this way, a very special message that you have a heart's desire to share that. There is no way they're going to let you in the front door if you come in there guns blazing. It just doesn't work.
Well, let me say this, and this may be surprising to most Americans, but immigrants tend to be humble people. And, mm-hmm. and the reason they're humble is that they often don't know the language when they come. So there's a level of embarrassment. And when my grandmother first came to the U.S. from the Netherlands, she remembers being mocked and ridiculed on the playground. So until an immigrant learns the language and becomes comfortable in English, there's going to be a sense of modesty or humility.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly have felt that in making this move. I don't come in as a loud, brash American, which is a stereotype. When I arrived, I realized how much I didn't know, and that I think that is more endearing to the culture than that opposite, that Homer Simpson is the stereotype American that Europeans are expecting, and I try my best not to be Homer Simpson.
Yeah, well, and there's some Americans that are native-born to this country, and they have trouble with the language in and of itself, but what it reminds me of is an event that happened at the Christian Station one morning. We had this one gentleman who did a live program, and he encouraged calls, and on his last show, and you'll understand why when I tell you, he was so upset about the fact that nobody was calling in. Little French guy. He referred to himself as Dr. Pierre LaFrance. And he referred to himself as the Doctor of Christ. And my first thought when I heard that, when he first came on the station, was, I didn't know he was sick. I didn't realize he needed a doctor. But this guy said on his very last program, he says, he's starting to rant and rave. Da, 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 da. What's the matter with your people? Don't you know I'm trying to save your lousy souls? And you can understand why. That was his last program. You can't go at it from that perspective. And yet, of course, we hear that all the time. And one of the things that has always it's frustrated me has been the fact that, as you and I would probably agree, the church isn't for the saved. The church is for the sinner. And yet, the church, and especially televangelism in the 80s and 90s, of which I was exposed to greatly, didn't really look at it that way. And they didn't want certain people in their pews. You know, so you actually had to go there incognito sometimes, which was really kind of sad because it was those people who really needed that connection, that community, that didn't get it. And I'm going to bet that you run into that around the world.
Yes, although I think that's a peculiarly American phenomenon. I hate to say it, the judging and the scolding and the arrogance that sometimes is a part of the American church.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's unique to the American church. I don't sense it from other cultures so much. And I'll give a guess here. I haven't done any research on this, but in the U.S., at least until now, the Christianity is the majority religion. I think that's changing, and that's scary to some people, but up until now, it's been the majority religion. So there could be a fair amount of arrogance. But for global Christians, and I suppose there are countries where this is an exception, but for most countries, Christians are not in the majority.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's far less arrogance in their approach to the faith. I mean, they're humble because they have to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, Richard, I think I should point something else out about the language, just in case there's a misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in an English-speaking church. So Switzerland has a national church and a state church, and if you were to go there, they would speak German in this part of the country. But what is attractive about my church to immigrant populations is that we offer worship in English. So
anyway, just to make that clear, the mm-hmm. people who come to us are looking for an English language service.
Yeah. I was fortunate. I was born and raised Roman Catholic. And my first wife, as I mentioned, her parents, her grandparents were from Russia. Her grandfather was from Russia. And their tradition was the Byzantine Rite of the Catholic Church, Eastern Rite. A lot of people think it's Orthodox. No, it's not Orthodox. It was still under the Pope. And I would attend Mass every Sunday when we were married, we would attend Mass every Sunday. And they did it in Slavonic, which was the language, the dialect, if you will, and English. And there are some phrases, some things I still remember. And again, I have a great love for the church in that regard. I love the ritual and the symbolism and the ceremony and so forth. Not so much the incense on a warm day. I almost passed out one day. They didn't have air conditioning in the church. At Easter, there is a phrase that when you greet someone, you say this phrase, and then there's the response from the other person. And it's the phrase in English is, Christ is risen. You say that. And then the response is, indeed, he is risen. Christos voskres, voyostenos voskres. And it's like, there are so many aspects to these different kinds of churches. I would agree with you that this is probably more of a uniquely American phenomenon, that the differences sometimes are what separate us from one another. Whereas around the world, for example, if I was to go to Russian countries where they had the Byzantine churches, I'd feel quite at home because it's familiar to me. And the other beauty of it is I actually have a copy of the liturgy at home. It's the same liturgy every Sunday. So you're not, it's like you could videotape it and play it every Sunday, put it up on the screen, and you miss nothing because that's the ritual. What about the diversity of Christian churches that you come across? You're there in Switzerland. They have their national church, as you say, and an English-speaking church and so forth. But when you go to other parts of the world, like you went to Thailand and so forth, I know that they have their Christian churches. But what about this aspect of incorporating, as it has been said, incorporating the local traditions into the Christian church so as not to alienate, if you will, the indigenous peoples of that country from the opportunity that you bring to them of sharing God's love with them and the gospel and so forth? How do you get over that hurdle so that they feel comfortable?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, it's a very interesting issue, and no matter what country you're in, I'm guessing there's this struggle between keeping the faith pure, I don't know of another word for it, and, mm-hmm. but also incorporating local customs and habits. So mm-hmm. every Christian expression is going to have a little bit of the local customs and habits. This is especially true in the U.S., and I think it's reached a dangerous point where the Christian Church and I was going to say the Republican Party, but the Christian Church and some political expression are just synonymous with each other, right? And so it's very hard to separate, or put it this way, it's very hard to know where one ends
and the other one
and
begins.
Maybe it's better if I say the evangelical wing of the church has become almost synonymous with the Republican Party. Well, in most cultures, there is some of that, where in an effort to reach the culture, there have been some accommodations and so on. So yes, it happens everywhere. And what's exciting to me about the international church is that none of that makes sense anymore. Once we come together, we have to let go of our national backgrounds, and we discover what the main thing is. And you say it's God's love. Well, yes, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you pare away, strip away some of these other things that don't really make sense anymore Right.
Yeah.
So many nationalities come together.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. Douglas Brower's my guest. We're talking about how to become a multicultural church, and we are going to continue that conversation here on the program. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and I ask you to please stay tuned. We're going to be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Douglas J. Brower. He's got a book out that we're talking about in particular, How to Become a Multicultural Church. And, of course, I don't think you can do it as an individual. I don't think an individual can be a church because it says where two or more are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst. Not to say that he's not there when you're by yourself, because he certainly is. But when we're talking about a church, it's a collective. It's not a building. It's not a set of rules and regulations. It's a community. And that's what we talk about here on this program, Douglas, is the importance of community. Under any banner, for that matter, quite honestly, that if we don't have that community, it's hard to get by. And I can, again, there are those, they like the solitary life. There are those who go off to the monastic orders and take the vows, for example, of silence, you know, where they don't speak another word for the rest of their lives. But this goes to another book that you wrote, and I wanted to touch upon this. This is a book that it's a series of letters that you wrote to your grandchildren. It's called The Truth About Who We Are. Now, that is a big subject to discuss with grandchildren, let alone with the rest of us.
Right.
Because I would have to say that I don't care what your personal philosophy is, what your core beliefs are, if you don't know who you are, and I mean the truth about who you are deep inside, this is something that we bring up on this program all the time, that's what I was talking about, we were discussing the subject of change. The one constant in the universe, immutable, is change. And that we have been sold a bill of goods that change is bad, okay? And we want stability, the phrase that's used after a lot of economic reports, regardless of what the numbers are. In these uncertain times, and I go, could you tell me when we were in certain times? I don't believe that ever existed. There were never certain times. So change is constant. But the only place where there is no change in terms of the core of who and what we are as immortal beings is love. That never changes.
We
might grow in our understanding of it, but it, if you will, doesn't. Talk to us about the journey that you've been on, understanding who you are, the truth about who Douglas J. Brower is.
Richard, I love it. I came prepared to talk about my book on the multicultural church, but you've looked at my more recent book. It came out last November, December. Yes, it's a letter to my grandchildren. I've got three. The oldest of the three is just 5 years old and started kindergarten, so they're not going to be able to read or understand this for quite a while. But yes, I did want to tell them about who they are. And as you know from looking at the book, I took a DNA test. I did quite a bit of genealogical work. I put together a family tree going back, you know, two or three centuries. And I looked at my family name, some surprises there about where that came from. And anyway, I tried to put all that together and then ask the question, who are we?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we an ethnic group? Well, yeah, sort of, and that's interesting. My name refers to an old profession, beer brewing.
Ah, there you go.
You know, we come from a long line of beer brewers. Is that who we are? Well, maybe. But anyway, where I come out, and I guess I'm not giving anything away here, is by saying, in the end, we are children of God. And we deserve to be treated that way, no less than children of God. We deserve the respect of people around us, but we were also created to give respect to people around us. So I think I came out in that book in what might be an unexpected place. Mm-hmm. But I do want my grandchildren to know where they came from and what their religious heritage is and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I'm just curious, not just as a pastor, but even as a grandfather and a father for that matter. Obviously you have kids because you have grandkids. How much willingness do you have to allow them to pursue their own philosophy of life, their own beliefs that could be way different than yours? And you certainly would love for them to follow in your footsteps, so to speak, but at the same time, I was born and raised in the Roman Catholic Church. One morning when I got home from delivering newspapers on a Sunday morning, I didn't want to go to Mass. And my mother said, okay. About 10, 15 years later, I asked her why she did that. She said, because I didn't want you to push away from the church. I never did. I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, but I certainly didn't put up a wall like a lot of, I'm an ex-Catholic for Jesus, and kind of stuff. I didn't go down that path. So what about your feelings in regards to, sharing this with them, but at the same time allowing them to find their own path?
Right. And what you've identified is a very troubling subject for lots of American parents these days. An entire generation, well, not the entire generation, but a large part of that generation, young adults, has simply walked away from the church. So the fastest growing religious category in the U.S. right now would be nuns, people who have no religious affiliation. And, it's obvious to most people who look out over a congregation today in the U.S. that it's aging. There are a lot of gray heads there. And the young adults are becoming fewer and fewer in number. Now, with my own kids, I don't know what to attribute this to, Richard, and I would love to say it's because I was such a great father, and I don't think that's the whole answer. I'd like to think I did a good job, but both of my daughters, who are now in their mid-30s, are churchgoers. In fact, my older daughter is also a Presbyterian pastor. So they have not walked away from the faith, but my grandchildren may well. As you say, mm-hmm. They may well decide not to adopt this point of view for themselves, and that was part of my reason for writing the book idea. My grandchildren don't know me as a pastor, which is wonderful. They've never seen me up in front of a church giving a sermon, so I wanted to write this book to them to say that's not the most important part of who I am. I'm proud of my career. I'm proud of what I did, but it's not the most important part of who I am. And now I want to tell you what is the most important part of who we all are. Right? That's where the story goes.
And to show them how accepting you are of them as members of the family, right?
Yep.
Regardless of what they choose to believe, hey, or who they become, what career they should take on. I mean, I have seen so many stories of families that have been just ripped apart, because the other siblings, even and the parents, just couldn't handle the particular path that the child or the brother sister were headed down. It wasn't necessarily a destructive path. It was just not, it was contrary to maybe what they had been taught all their lives. And it's like, but this is what I want to do. It's kind of like the kid who says, I'm not going to go to college. I'm going to pursue art. And of course, parents usually, you do know there's no money in art. Well, not unless you're really good, of course, or music and that kind of thing. And yet it's those attributes that really have formed the basis for a lot of people. I mean, some of the artwork, for example, some of the music, especially classical music. Oh, my goodness, such inspiration. I love the Grammys when you get artists that come up there, you know, and they say, yeah, my foundation, I sung in the church. Or, I mean, even if it was a rock band or heavy metal or something, it's, oh, yeah, my first influence was classical music. And you can sit there going, really? Seriously? Yeah. And it's and again, you just never know which direction people are going to go. It's amazing what influence. So those are the kinds of things that I find so interesting. And my parents have been very, very open about, first of all, allowing us to choose our own paths. But I even remember after my divorce, my one and only, I want you to know, I will never do it again. So I am making it, I'm taking every effort to make sure this one, it goes to the, it does the duration. I used to ask them, well, why, you know, they would tell me, oh, yeah, we knew this and that and the other thing. I was like, well, why didn't you say something then, you know, when there were the problems? Well, we didn't want to interfere. It's like, and so you're telling me now, you know. But that was one of the things that they were very clear about to all of us. And I had a chance to interview my parents, who are now in their upper 80s. My dad's 88, my mother 85, doing well health-wise. But they said that we made the decision at the very beginning that unless you wanted, and this is after we became of age, you know, accountable age, 16, 17, 18, that unless you wanted our help, we were not going to interfere. As hard as that is for us to do, that was the position that they took. And I have to tell you, I appreciated that. I really did. Because I did go to them many times, even in my first marriage, because I figured, well, at the time, you know, it was like they'd been married 30 or 40 years. I figured, well, heck, they've got 30, 40 years experience. They should know how to help us or give us some advice. You know, and matter of fact, they just finished celebrating, I think it was their 66th, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So wonderful. Anyway, it's one of those things that makes our society and our culture grow is family. And sometimes they're relatives, and sometimes they're people you choose. So when you are outside the boundaries of the United States and you're in other countries, are you seeing that there is a strong, I want to use the word affinity, but I want something even stronger than that, but for lack of a better word, are you seeing that that family and community are really fundamental to a lot of the communities that you visit?
Yes, and you're going to be surprised, I think, about what I'm going to say. Church attendance in Europe is very low. And there's just no question about that. But the legacy of the church is very much in evidence. So, for example, the stores are not open on Sunday in most of Switzerland and in much of Europe. Why is that? Because I think it's because of the legacy of the church and the importance of family. Sunday is a family day, and to open up a shop on Sunday would be, it would be unthinkable.
Sacrilege.
Right? Because, yeah. So the family is that important. We've got to hang on to this time. And then people do, family members do spend time together. I'm just shocked. If I need to buy something on Sunday, well, usually it just can't happen. But the only stores that are open are at the train station, the central train station.
Mm. So
if I'm really desperate, I've got to run over there because no other stores.
Yeah.
Are open. I think that's a vestige of the Christian church.
And I have to say that I grew up with that here in the States, in Phoenix, where many of the shops were closed on Sunday. The convenience stores were open, that kind of thing. But for the most part, if you needed to get anything done that you normally would do during the week, you better do it during the week. I mean, that's just the way that it was.
Right.
And, there was a certain level of frustration, but at the same time, it's like, well, that's just the way that it is. And it's okay. And then all of a sudden, it started to change. And I thought, oh, this just feels weird. You're not supposed to be open today. You should be off with family and what have you. And I know that there are communities popping up around the country in particular, as well as around the world, but in this country, who are trying to trying to revisit, not necessarily going back in time per se, but getting back to the core values, if you will, the core elements of what makes a community. You know, the small town kind of thing. I mean, I live in Santa Barbara, 80 to 90,000 people in Santa Barbara proper, but along the South Coast, probably, I don't know, 200,000-300,000 or something. I don't know what the number would be, but anyway, but you still know. A matter of fact, one day I was going to three or four different places throughout the city here in Santa Barbara. I ran into the same person three or four times, and of course my joke to her on the third encounter was, "Are you following me? Are you stalking me?" But you that's what happens. But in Phoenix, you didn't have that happen, unless people stayed pretty much in their own neighborhoods, in their own areas. But if you traveled outside, your block or your 1 mile square where you lived, you probably would never come across the same people twice. Whereas in a small community, everybody, in a manner of speaking, knows everybody else's business, cares about one another, is concerned when somebody doesn't show up for church or for work or for whatever it is that's going on. And I find that that's really kind of cool. On the one hand, because privacy in a small town, well, yeah, maybe it is a little difficult to come by, but at least you know people, so to speak, have your back. And that's kind of what's missing in the rural area, the urban areas of our country, is in spite of what we see when there are disasters, like down in Houston or in Miami and the big cities and so forth, when you have the hurricanes or tornadoes or other natural disasters, and people come together. I mean, we had the mudslides in Montecito following the Thomas Fire a couple of years ago, and people just came together. It didn't matter what you believed. It didn't matter what political persuasion you were. It didn't matter how much money you had in the bank, assuming the bank was still around. You were a human being. You were suffering, you were hurting, you were suffering loss. Hey, what can I do to help? And it's like, if only we could foster that without the natural disasters, without the catastrophes and so forth. That would say that we as human beings have finally moved outside the walls of the cave.
There is a hunger for that, isn't there? The feeling of community that's definitely been lost, as you say, in the urban areas, but probably in other places too. Sprawling suburbs where people just don't know each other very well. Yes, I think there's a hunger for that. You're right.
Yeah. But you are seeing that kind of connectedness. Even if church attendance globally and in these other countries that you visit is down, you still do see that community that exists, as you described. You know, the places are closed on Sunday because that's family day. You know, that's encouraging.
Richard, I want to say church attendance is down in Europe, mm-hmm. and I think it's been on the decline ever since the end of World War II. But that's not true in other places around the world. I think in several countries in Asia and Africa, the church is undergoing just exponential growth. So I want to make that clear.
Sure. No. I understand. This is really extraordinary. Now, by the way, I want to let our listeners know too that you can go to Douglas's website, which of course is douglasblog.org. Douglasblog.org.
Doug's blog.
I beg your
Douglas,
pardon.
But Doug's blog.
Doug's. D-O-U-G-S. My best friend. I went through grade school, high school, and college with my best friend Doug Jones, and we had a great time. I got to tell you, we had a great time growing up together. And so it's dougsblog.org. We'll get that correct. Absolutely. Also, you've written several other books as well. We won't have time to jump in, but I want to let our listeners know that you've got some books entitled What Am I Supposed to Do with My Life? Oh, man, we could spend another program just on that alone. Another one is called I Heard It at the Potluck, Hope and Hilarity for People Under the Steeple. Another one is called Remembering the Faith, What Christians Believe. And then there's also Beyond I Do, What Christians Believe About Marriage. I also remind you about How to Become a Multicultural Church, available at dougsblog.org. And Doug, I want to thank you so much for giving us this time all the way from Switzerland. I know that the sun has gone down and it's getting dark there, and you're probably about ready for dinner on your end. I thank you again for sharing with us your story, as well as the work that you're doing. And you know, if your efforts help to bring about a sense of inner peace within the people that you work around, then peace around the world is a real possibility, that we could stop all of this crazy stuff that has been going on for centuries. But again, it has to start within each one of us. Forget about, I remember hearing this a long time ago, and of course, I know that Gandhi is often quoted as saying, you know, be the peace you want to see. But if we don't have peace within ourselves, and I think that goes to the core of what you talked about earlier, knowing who you truly are. And only then can you really have that peace. What is it, the biblical passage? Ye shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Well, if you know the truth yourself, and you know who you are, this is not about judgment here. This is not about blame. It's just about an understanding of who you are deep inside. You start sharing that with other people, and God, who knows what miracles can happen?
Richard, it has been a treat to talk to you. You have a lively mind, and I just found it, I had a good time talking with you today.
Well, thank you. Should you come back to the States and want to visit us here in Santa Barbara, I'd love to have you in studio to continue the conversation on some of the other subjects that you talk about in your other books as well. And before I let you go, I have three final questions for you that I ask all of my guests. You may have answered them to some degree in the context of the interview, but I like to ask the questions directly. Before I do, reminder, it's dougsblog.org is the website, and How to Become a Multicultural Church is the title of the book we've been talking about for the most part throughout the program. And also a reminder that if you would like to support this program, we're grateful for any support you give us. PayPal and Patreon account links are on our website. Doug, my first question to you of the three is, who is Douglas J. Brower?
Husband, father, grandfather, Presbyterian pastor, author, and a child of God. Not necessarily in that order.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I would like other people to know what I myself have found. I told you the story about finding God's unconditional love in my life, God's grace. As soon as I found that, I wanted to let other people know what I had found. So that's been my life's mission.
And finally, this goes to the title of one of your books. What is your life's purpose?
You know, I think I'm blessed because I found it early in my life. I do know from my pastoral work that other people struggle sometimes throughout their lives. But my life's purpose has been in communicating what I know to be true. And so what I know to be true is God's love for me and God's love for the people who listen to your show. That is what animates my life.
Well, Doug, once again, thank you for joining us and for sharing what you have here on the program. And I thank you for listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.